Okay, I don't want to mispronounce your name. Joel, I can say and feel confident about.
Boehnerman.
Joel, you sound like an American. Where are you from and how did you get here?
Canadian, actually. I came here in 1977, stayed around for a while, came back a few times, and came back to live in 1982 after finishing graduating from the University of Toronto, and I've been here ever since. I've lived 5 years in Jerusalem, 9 years in Beit Shemesh, 10 years in Zichron Yaakov, and I live in Tekoa, in Gush Etzion.
What were you doing in Canada, and what brought you here?
I just really finished university. I didn't work professionally in Canada. And when I came here in 82, 83, I became a journalist, for lack of a better profession, or anything else that I could really do. And it was also at the time when Israel's economy was changing and becoming much more high-tech. I grabbed that very quickly and saw that that was something that I could really go with. And before long, I was writing about technology and business, things that I did not study in university, didn't know anything about. But I found there was a welcome market abroad for my articles about Israeli companies, Israeli technology, high-tech business, and I figured this is where I'm going to be. Forget about everything else. This is going to be good. Because it was very much a secret back then in the early 80s, mid-80s. You know, you really had to promote it to convince people that Israel had something other than oranges or debts or charity or whatever. And now, of course, you don't have to promote Israeli high-tech. Everyone knows about it. But I was one of the very, very first, not only English language writers, but any writer in Israel who specialized in writing about high tech and how it was going to change the economy and the future of Israel, and it certainly did.
What is there about Israeli high tech that's so high tech?
Well, typically, you know, Israelis go out and look for solutions to solve technological problems. They don't just look for a solution. It has to be an elegant solution. It has to be wow. And that's characteristic of the Israeli mentality and Israeli-minded. Israelis go out and solve problems. They don't just develop the next generation of products. They go out and look for a problem that has not been solved and then go out and solve it. And typically, most people say, nah, it can't be done, it can't be done, it can't be done. And that's all the, you know, Israeli has to hear, and that's it. Forget it. And 6 months later, a year later, he's done it. So I think the real expertise of Israel, at least then from the mid-80s, I would say, to the mid-90s, was great technology, great engineering. Since the mid-90s, and particularly in the last 3 to 4 years, Israeli entrepreneurialism in general has overshadowed high-tech, although it has not got the headlines that high-tech gets. You know, every time an American company buys an Israeli company, everyone celebrates it as something. Well, you know, it's good for the guy who founded the company. It's good for their investors. It doesn't help the economy all that much, although it brings in foreign currency. Entrepreneurialism is something else completely. And here you see recently in the last 3 or 4 years where Israeli companies, and most of them not in high tech, are going out to the world and taking what they've developed here, meaning a retail concept or whatever. Again, most of it's not in high tech, and conquered the world with it. I mean, you see that in cafes now. You see it in clothing stores. I mean, you wouldn't believe how many Israeli companies have stores, have chain stores abroad. And they don't promote them as Israeli stores, obviously, but it's quite phenomenal when you think of it, even in the area of coffee, where the 3 Israeli chain stores operating cafes in the United States and in Europe. That's pretty, that's something, even in Paris, believe it or not, in New York, Israeli chocolates. So, you know, on the retail level, which was never really a strong area of Israel, you know, marketing, retail. I remember I used to hear everyone say, Israelis are good at developing, they don't know how to market. That's really old. Israelis know very well how to market. There's one thing about Israelis. Once they realize that they're not doing something right, they learn very, very quickly. And then they surpass most other people. Until they get to the point where they realize they don't know it or they don't. And that used to be very typical characteristics of Israeli business people, Israeli marketers. Today, it's not at all. I mean, they start off with the marketing and they start off with that as opposed to developing the product and then looking for the market. And Israelis are now phenomenally successful in, of course, real estate. I mean, there are Israeli companies building everywhere in the world, and in some places actually dominating certain areas. As I said about chain stores, retail stores, selling everywhere in the world. Israelis are no longer confined. they're no longer confined by this mentality that we're small little Israel and, you know, we'll always be a tiny little economy. And the fact is, locally, domestically, we're not a tiny economy anymore with 7 million people. But even so, Israelis no longer, you know, see that going abroad and marketing abroad or doing business abroad as this huge, major hurdle. Where 20 years ago, 15 years ago, 10 years ago, Israelis, a lot of them went abroad when they weren't ready. A lot of them didn't think about it enough. Now, when they go abroad, they are prepared. They know exactly what has to be done. They know what they need in terms of financing. They know everything they have to need to know to survive and to prosper. And that's something very different from even maybe 5, 6, 7 years ago. So, you know, people tell me about high tech. I said, high tech is fine. It's wonderful. But the fact is that what we need to do in Israel is have an economy that's centered, that's basically part of the world global economy. And I'm going to give an example about this. It's very interesting. 3-4 weeks ago, there was a visit here by the president of Alcoa. Alcoa is the largest aluminum company in the United States and probably the world, you know, the aluminum foil, whatever. They came to Israel and they found a company here that had developed a certain type of product for aluminum siding. Doesn't really matter what it is. It's for the construction industry. And they set up a joint venture here not to sell, not to make the product here, not to develop the product here. They're doing that anyway. But to reach the Israeli contractors who are building abroad so that they can buy Alcoa's products and then use it in their buildings abroad. And if you think about that, that really means that Israel has become a center of the global economy in a sense. Because if you have Israelis doing business around the world, and you have people coming here, big multinationals coming here in order to reach them, because they know that they don't only just market in Israel, but they market around the world, well, that's really a sign that Israel's really made it. We are here. And of course, I'll just add, we're here economically, we're here politically. And no one's ever going to boycott Israel. All that Arab boycott always failed because Israel was too strong. And today, with Israel's economy at about $200 billion, no one's going to displace Israel politically. And I think we'll get into this a little bit later, but I think one of the things that a lot of people make the mistake on the left is with this disinvestment idea that you're going to force Israel to change its policies by forcing companies to disinvest from Israel. That's nonsense. What went on in South Africa was a completely different economic situation than Israel, and it will never work in Israel only because the concentration of the economy isn't there to make it work like it is in South Africa.
You've given us a wonderful wrap-up of the last years. What do you see coming in the forwards?
Well, the last 3 or 4 months, I've been, I moved from the north, from Zichron Yaakov down to Tekoa, which is a Yishuv Kilati over the Green Line in the Gush Etzion, just southeast of Bethlehem. And I moved there not because I wanted to be a settler. I had some people there, some friends, and it was actually one of the only places in the area of Jerusalem that a single could move to. Although I live with my son, I'm not, that doesn't make a difference. Anyway, I moved there, and moving there forced me to see a couple of things. I mean, throughout the years, I've written about politics. I wrote a book about politics. I wrote newsletters. My specialty area was always business, economics, and finance, but I always dealt with politics, and I was kept pretty much up to date on what was going on. And, you know, being up in the north there, you know, when the pullout from Gaza took place, you saw it on TV. You didn't really, weren't really a part of it. And then the whole idea about the wall, you know, the so-called security wall. I say so-called because it's not really, that's not its function, its first function. Its first function is a political border to separate Israelis from the Palestinians politically. But, you know, when you move into Gush Etzion and you see the wall there at Efrat, and you every day you go past it and you ask yourself, why are they building this wall? I mean, it can't be for security reasons because you can lob a missile over one side to the other and kill lots of people. It can't be for security. It forced me to look at the whole question of not only the security wall, the so-called security wall, but also the whole pullout from Gaza, and ask myself, were they connected? Because they were not connected in the mainstream media. There were two different functions. As a matter of fact, the security wall never got approval from the Israeli government even. It was not something that required approval from the Israeli government. It was a Ministry of Defense, even though it was a political act. So the more and more I looked at it, I asked myself, well, why did Sharon leave Gaza? You know, and I looked at all these stories from the right saying, oh, he did that because he wanted to deflect attention away from his sons being charged. And I got to tell you, that was just a bunch of nonsense. There was absolutely no proof of anything against them in terms of a corruption. They had nothing. They eventually dropped all the charges. The timing doesn't make play, isn't in place either. And I got to tell you, most of the right wing in Israel, the intellectual right, I call it, those that write and whatever, were completely out to lunch on this one. They had no idea. They didn't have an answer, so they said, ah, yeah, it's because they made up some sort of nonsense about his son. It's because of his sons. And the fact is, his sons, even if they were charged and one was already, minor league corruption. You know, by Israeli standards, minor league. Sharon didn't have anything to fear, and Sharon wasn't involved in it in many respects, and they had nothing on Sharon. The real reason I came to the conclusion was that at first I came to the conclusion that maybe, and this was after a lot of research I did on that whole time period of, you know, late 2003 until he left office from his stroke. I looked at all the statements he made, and I came to the conclusion, he came to the conclusion that the Palestinians were a demographic threat, and therefore he had to put up the wall in order to separate them, which was the prevailing mentality of most of the military establishment. Now, most people in Israel don't really hear that word, military establishment, Mimsad, Mimshel, Bitroni, because you hear about it in the States, military-industrial complex, but you never hear about it in Israel. Well, there is a military establishment, both current and past generals and reservists and everyone, who make up the mainstream prevailing viewpoint of what Israel should do. And it changes perhaps every 10 years. I mean, I don't know, because it's hard to go up to someone and actually interview them because it's not in the public eye. But it changes everyone's day. And I think at that point when Sharon was in power, he was influenced by many of these generals who believed, thinking like a general, that there is no other solution. We tried the Palestinian state with Oslo. That didn't work. Military occupation, okay, fine, we have no problem with that, but we have to do something to ensure that they Palestinians can't come into Israel and go around it. So they said, put up a wall, and Sharon listened to them. And probably he had no other person telling him anything else, and mostly everyone else went along with it for the security reasons. But again, I'm going to say it's a political wall. It's the political border. It's there for political reasons. So I began to think about that more and more, and I said, okay, that's the case. I said, but what do you do economically? Because I had, from my late 80s, I began to look at the whole economic aspect of the Arab-Israeli conflict, and particularly the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. And I went to Ramallah and interviewed the economists and business people and heard their complaints and heard the Israeli complaint. From those days in the late 80s, early 90s, this was before Oslo, when, you know, the question of would a Palestinian state be economically, would it survive economically was just theory, you know, in the air. Then Oslo came about. And, of course, during Oslo, you know, the PA didn't do anything. They didn't build a building. They didn't take one refugee out of a refugee camp to build permanent housing. They did nothing. They did less than nothing. They really did nothing. And so we tried that. And economically, you know, I remember writing in the late 80s and early 90s a couple of op-eds in Christian Science Monitor and the Globe and Mail in Toronto saying basically that if the place that the Palestinians create isn't economically prosperous, even if it's politically stable, it won't be politically stable for very long. That assumes it's politically stable. We learned from the first Oslo that they didn't even get that far. But even if it was politically stable, it had to be economically prosperous. And that's only to provide the jobs and the housing for the people that the Arabs that live now in the West Bank and in Gaza. Forget about 5, 6, 7 million refugees streaming back in. And, you know, I wrote that then, and then I remember, you know, about 2 days before they signed the deal with Oslo in September 1993, I had a book in at a major publisher in New York, and it was on the economic dimensions of the Arab-Israeli conflict. And I remember getting a call from them the day after they signed the agreement saying that the editors decided we don't want to go ahead with the book. I said, why? And then they said, well, peace is already here. You see, they signed the peace treaty. We don't need the book anymore. It's all theory. So, and then time went on in the mid-90s, I actually got out of journalism in the mid-90s because I saw the internet was going to change a lot of things for quality journalists. It was going to get harder and harder to convince newspapers to pay for quality writing because there was going to be so much more and everything, and I was 100% right on with that. That was 96, 97. I started getting into some other things and consulting and stuff like that. And I was out of journalism completely until I moved down to Gush Etzion and started looking at these issues again. And, of course, after I got to the point where I realized that Sharon put up a wall there for political reasons, I asked myself, okay, now what's going to happen economically? Are we just going to continue on where they have no jobs, the Palestinians? They don't raise their standard of living. They get worse, actually, year after year. And that's it. That's going to be the end of the story. So I developed, you know, these concepts of economic union, which basically economic union means that if you merge the Palestinian and the Israeli economies together, Israel would be like 98.99% of it, and the Palestinians would be 1.4% of that merged entity. So reality is that the Israelis are going to be the economic engine regardless. And we're already in a state where the two economies are already totally integrated. I mean, they're our largest trading partner. Actually, they're our second largest trading partner. We are by far the majority of their largest trading partner. And there's no real justification to do anything economically in the West Bank because you could probably import anything cheaper than actually producing it. That's not to say they don't have expertise in certain areas and things like that. But for the most part, you know, I'll put it very bluntly, they're really up a creek without a paddle economically without Israel. And it was always that way. I mean, after 67, it was always that way. Today, it's even more stark, the appearance of it on the landscape, because you can see that today, without Israel, they will go absolutely nowhere economically, because come to the conclusion the Palestinian state probably is never going to be. We tried it once. It didn't work. And as much as everyone, you know, blames Israel, or the left loves to blame Israel for it, Israel didn't do that. The fact is, we tried it once. It didn't work. You know, then there was an intifada, which obviously Arafat decided he wanted to war with Israel, which wasn't the most intelligent thing to do, but he wanted a war with Israel. And now you have a point where, what are they doing? You know, you open the papers today, you read about, what do? They talk about Palestinian state, but what's interesting is the way they talk about it. The way they, it's a ipso facto, it's de facto already, it's just there, we just got okay it, and there's the Palestinian state. And it's amazing how nobody, and I mean absolutely nobody from the far left to the far right to Paris, Sharon, nobody thinks about what are the economic aspects of this particular issue, because that's bottom line. If it doesn't work economically, who cares what you do politically? And that's where my solution comes in, because I came to the conclusion that there's only one solution to the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, and that is a one-state solution. Now, one-state solution to the far left, people like Uri Davis and Ilan Pape, people like that on the internet, you can find these guys. They talk about this confederation, one state. It doesn't have a Jewish identity or an Arab identity. It's for both people. Similar to back in the early 30s when Martin Buber and Yehuda Mainz also promoted these ideas. Never went anywhere. But that's what they talk about when they talk about a one-state solution. When I talk about a one-state solution, it's a completely different scenario. My one-state solution is Israel. There is no other state, because I've come to the conclusion that the Palestinians will never have an independent state. And even if they did, it would last for about a year, and it would go down the tubes. So I have no faith in their ability to provide the stability and economic prosperity to have that country grow. And don't forget, it took the Jews from the early 20s throughout to about the early 40s to build the economic infrastructure for their state. I don't think the Palestinians will do it in any less than that time. That's 20 years, which means they have to have political stability for 20 years and to do that. Now, the Jews did have political stability because they had the British being the security element, the umbrella. And for better or for worse, the British really enabled the Jews to build up their infrastructure under their security umbrella, which to me was probably the reason why there was a mandate to begin with. But that's another story. So you know, I've come to the conclusion that the Palestinians will not have a Palestinian state, at least in the next, let's say, 5 to 10, 12 years, midterm forward. If that's the case, what do? We continue with a status quo of military occupation. We put up a fence. We say, we don't care what you do over there, just don't come over here. Meanwhile, there's no jobs, there's no economic development, there's nothing except join a gang and make a little bit of money by shooting somewhere. It's not going to solve a problem. It's not even going to make a problem get better. Nothing is going to get better for them with that. And the fact is, from their perspective, they have no alternative.